genocide, Israeli genocide in Gaza. United States has provided not only financial aid, but all the F-16s and all the weapons which are being used to exterminate Palestinians in Gaza.
Demonstrators held the U.S. and its European allies responsible for the killing of tens of thousands of innocent Palestinians by supplying weapons that fueled the bloodshed and for shielding Israel from international accountability.
America, which claims to be a champion of human rights, why does it turn a blind eye to Gaza? Men, women, and children are being slaughtered every day with U.S. weapons in the hands of Israel.
Protesters highlighted the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, where men, women, and children remain trapped under the siege with no access to food, medicine, or shelter.
Women are being killed by Israel, children are being killed by Israel, but no one is there to speak for them. We all know that Israel is international terrorist.
Israel is a ghasib riyasat hai.
Israel is an occupying regime and fomenting terrorism. It bombs schools, hospitals, and refugee camps. Any country that supports such brutality is supporting terrorism itself.
Many called for boycotting American and Israeli products, saying economic resistance was their way to support Palestine.
As Israeli attacks continue in Gaza, protests are spreading worldwide with calls for an end to the genocide and urgent aid for millions trapped under siege. Asif Kazmi, Islamabad.
...2025 on its final day in Tehran, as Iran's largest trade fair for electronics, computers and e-commerce, the 28th edition of the exhibition has over the past 4 days hosted local and international companies, turning Tehran into a hub for digital dialogue and innovation.
This is our first participation at Elecomp. As a smart display manufacturer, we received strong interest in both home and automotive devices. We look forward to returning to Iran and are already planning marketing and customer follow-ups.
Our team is proud to take part in Elecomp for the first time. We have come to Iran to showcase our products and services, aiming to meet the needs of this growing market.
Artificial intelligence has also taken center stage this year. From smart platforms to data solutions, many companies present their AI-driven products and services.
Our company, active in the IT industry, has recently focused on AI PC, with our latest product being an AI camera. At Elecomp, we also met Arab companies, and discussions began on future collaborations.
For participants, Elecomp is more than an exhibition. It's a space to introduce new products, connect with international investors, and exchange experiences within the wider tech community.
At Elecomp, we showcase our latest data center products, including power panels and monitoring systems. The exhibition was a valuable chance to exchange ideas, meet new customers, and connect with both local and international companies. Connections we look forward to developing future.
We offer gaming accessories, and our main audience is Gen Z and those active in the gaming community. We welcomed visitors from different countries, and after the exhibition we hope to expand our connections and exchange more experiences.
Elecomp 2025 has underscored the momentum of Iran's digital sector, setting the stage for new collaborations and innovation in the tech industry.
Elecomp 2025 in Tehran brought together inventors, startups and innovators, highlighting Iran's expanding tech market and its growing role in the global digital economy. Farzan Anshoryal, Tehran.
In the courtyards of Tehran's Qasr Garden Museum, stories of courage and endurance echo once more. The Generation of Resistance ceremony has brought together families of political prisoners martyred before the revolution, many of whom endured torture, exile, and loss, yet upheld the vision of an independent Islamic Republic.
After being tortured many times by the Pahlavi regime, my husband was sentenced to death by firing squad, They didn't even give us his body to bury, and to this day, we still don't know where he is. That's how fearful they were of the ideas and beliefs held by him and his fellow prisoners. I was also arrested with him for our activities against the regime. It's important for future generations to know our independence did not come easily.
Attendees heard tributes from officials honoring martyrs' contributions across decades, from resisting Pahlavi oppression to defending Iran in the imposed 8-year war.
My late husband endured brutal torture, to the point they had to take him to hospital. He fell into a coma from the intense abuse and was left paralyzed, but he never gave in to the pressure. He was a brave man, and I am proud of him.
I was one of the founders of the Students' Islamic Association in Stockholm. When I realized I should return to help the political movement for an Islamic Republic, I was sentenced to 12 years in prison for my activism. The younger generation must know the Islamic Republic did not come easily, and we must protect it.
The ceremony also unveiled a memorial dedicated to 66 martyrs, political prisoners who perished under torture, in targeted assassinations, or on the front lines of the Holy Defense.
The resistance of our martyrs is the reason we have independence and freedom today. Their stories of sacrifice should be taught in school textbooks, so children grow up knowing what was given for their future.
For the mothers, sisters, and former comrades who took part in the ceremony, this remembrance is more than history. It is a living pledge to continue the path of sacrifice.
Martyrdom is intertwined in Iranian culture, and this occasion has provided an opportunity to honor martyrs and the values they sacrificed their lives for. Tehran.
The Israeli military offensive dubbed Iron Wall, which began in the Jenin refugee camp, has now entered its 250th day. The regime forces have carried out repeated incursions, demolitions, and large-scale arrests ever since, leaving civilians to bear the brunt of the violence. Local and international organizations report that at least 100 Palestinians have been killed since the beginning of the campaign.
Life as a displaced person is incredibly hard. Every day feels empty and unfair. Nothing can balance the hardships we face. But my wife has been my strength throughout with her love, patience, and support. She even sacrificed her own possessions to help us survive and work together side by side. I don't know where I would be without her. She gives me hope, courage, and the will to keep moving forward. Our love is the only thing that makes life bearable in these times, and I'm endlessly grateful for her presence in my life.
Beyond the human toll, the scale of destruction is staggering. More than 5,220 homes and buildings have been demolished, including residential units, shops, and public infrastructure. The damage has forced thousands of families into an already dire humanitarian situation, with many unable to return to their neighborhoods.
I miss the normalcy of life, waking up to familiar sounds, the smell of fresh bread from the bakery, children playing in the streets. I miss my garden, my small courtyard, the evening spent with family and neighbors. Here, there's nothing like that. Every day is the same, long, empty, and full of waiting. I dream that one day I can return home, even for a little while, just to feel the air there, walk in the streets, see my family's belongings.
I've been displaced since the very beginning of the invasion. My home is just a few meters away, but I can't reach it. I see it from a distance every day, and it's heartbreaking. Everything I built, all my memories are gone. Life has stopped. There's no work, no school for the children, nothing normal anymore. We live in fear and uncertainty. Every night is full of anxiety. It's like we don't exist, trapped between what was and what might be.
The continued displacement of around 50,000 Palestinians highlights the growing crisis. Families are scattered across temporary shelters, relatives' homes, and overcrowded facilities, with limited access to health care, clean water, and basic supplies. The humanitarian toll is deepening as the operation prolongs.
The West Bank continues to face severe devastation under Israel's Iron Wall operation. Communities are shattered, homes demolished, and thousands of families forced to flee as the humanitarian crisis deepens. Tiba Asi, Occupy Jenin.
Doctors for Palestine, bikers for Palestine, and people from all walks of life took to the streets of Germany in some of the largest demonstrations against Israeli genocide in Gaza since the Al-Aqsa flood operation in 2023. 20,000 people, some organizers say even 30,000, joined the protest march in Düsseldorf, which was organized by Arab and Muslim communities.
It didn't start on October 7. The genocide started in 1948. We will never stop to resist it. No matter what the police does here in Germany, we will never stop supporting Palestine until it's free.
The demonstration was spearheaded by a group of over 50 activists on motorbikes from the group Bikers for Palestine. Speakers from various pro-Palestine campaign groups addressed the protest.
We lit the torch of freedom with Gaza. Following the freedom of Palestine, we will carry it further to wherever oppression exists. In Sudan, Yemen, Congo, everywhere where people are fighting for freedom, and also here in Germany.
Speakers criticized the ongoing German support for Israel, including the continued arms trade and the signing of a new trade agreement on Friday, as well as the repression of Palestine solidarity activism in the country.
Because my whole heart, my whole brain, my whole being, as my whole existence is for Palestine, and we really have to free this beautiful country, this beautiful people, and we have to stop this genocide.
Speakers and participants also expressed their support for Lebanon, Yemen and Iran against the Israeli aggression.
I'm here to make a statement for Palestine, but also for Lebanon. A year ago, much Lebanese blood was shed. Lebanon lost a precious treasure on September 27th with the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and the brutal pager attack. They accepted everything and supported Palestine. When we say free Palestine, we also mean Lebanon, Yemen and Iran.
It is a tsunami of fascism and hatred sweeping across Gaza, and it didn't stop in Germany. The repression and oppression frighten me. The long-prepared hatred of Muslims in Germany frightens me. Zionism will fall because we are fighting it and we're millions.
Two separate demonstrations were also held in the capital, Berlin, which attracted up to 100,000 participants. At a smaller protest in Berlin, several arrests were made.
Tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people march in solidarity with Palestine across Germany this weekend. Pressure is mounting on Friedrich Merz and his government to recognize the state of Palestine. Another mass demonstration against the ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza and the wars in Eastern Europe will be held in Berlin on Friday. Dieter Reinisch, Düsseldorf.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar. A lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bless you all. We've gathered for this gathering to celebrate the birth anniversary of our 11th Imam, Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salatu wasalam. Before I go to the main theme, where I'll be talking about some of the selected sayings of the Imam as a source of guidance for us, let me give you the historical background of the time in which the Imam lived. He was born in the year 232 of the Hijra in Medina, and his demise happened in 260 in Samarra. He lived only for 28 years, and the imamate was the last 6 years. So the life of the Imam was not that long, nor the year of his imamate. But we do realize that those 6 years of the imamate was a year, this is the era where Imam went through major challenges. Constantly he was under surveillance or virtual house arrest, to the extent that there was a time period in those 6 years where he was required to present himself to the minister once a week. And even there, you know, Imam would actually communicate to his Shias to say, because people would be, you know, gathering from the door of his house all the way to the palace of the minister or the Khalifa himself sometimes. They would gather there to see him, and he used to say to his Shias, if you come, just be like anyone else. Do not show any extra devotion or respect to me, because they are watching you also. So it's not only that they were watching the Imam, anyone who was connected to the Imam would also be part of their surveillance and then harassment, basically. Yet the Imam, in those 6 years, you know, found ways of keeping in touch with his followers and his Shias. And this was done by the extensive network of wakala, the agents that the Imam had appointed. And this was a system that he inherited from his grandfather, which was further expanded by his father, and even further by himself. And so it was either through the wakala that he would communicate with his followers, or also we see, you know, exchange of letters from the Shias to the Imam. But this was not done that easily, especially keeping in mind that this was the threshold of the era of Ghaibat, which was very crucial for the Imam to make sure that his message is reaching to the community. I'll give you just two examples of how dangerous situation was, yet the Imam and his wakala found ways of communicating with him. What is the example of Imam himself? He actually would write the response to the letters of the people asking, you know, different questions people would have or different requests for dua or sayings and things like that. He would actually write those answers. And he had some special walking sticks made for himself, which were hollow inside. So he could open it, you know, fold the letters, and then put into that hollow, you know, area inside the walking stick. And we know about it because there was one very interesting incident. One day, Imam gave the walking stick to his slave, and he said, go and take this to the house of Usman al-Amri, who was the main wakil and the agent of the Imam. Even the servant and the slave didn't know the secret of this walking stick. He just thought it's a, you know, it's asa, you know, walking stick that Imam is giving as a gift to Usman al-Amri. But then he, going to the house of Osman, He happened to pass by an alley where there were a couple of donkeys coming through. It was a narrow alley, so in order to push the donkeys away so that he has some way to pass by, he actually used the stick to hit one of them. But this stick was not solid. It was hollow inside. And when he did that, he saw it cracked. And he could see from the crack, it didn't break totally, that there were papers inside. So immediately, you know, he put his hand there to hide and hold that area. And this is where we come to realize that even those who were close to the Imam wouldn't know that how Imam was, you know, extraordinary ways of trying to convey the letters even to his wakil, who would then further, you know, send it to those who had asked the questions. So this is as far as the Imam is concerned. Usman al-Amri, a prominent name, you know, during that time in Samarra, people knew him. How would he communicate with the Imam? Because the Shias would send letters to him, especially the wujuhat, khums and other, you know, religious dues, would be given to him to convey to the Imam. He couldn't go with all these things, you know, openly to the house of the Imam. So Usman al-Amri adapted the work of an oil vendor. Not that he has a shop for it. He would actually put these pots of, you know, oil with oil in it on the cart, and he would go to the neighborhood of the Imam selling oil to the people. You know, you have this, in Canada you don't have that, but, you know, people come to door to door to sell things, whether it's sabzi or other things. And so Usman al-Amri, in spite of his status in the society, he adopted this method because many of those jars or the pots contain oil. This is what he was trying to show. But many of them that he knew were empty. Empty of oil, but filled with letters or the money which was given to the Imam. And when he would reach to the house of the Imam, you know, he would just be knocking and said, you know, I have the items that the Imam had asked for, and he will take those one or two pots or whatever they were there, take it inside and leave it there. And so this is where you get a you know, a sense of the very precarious situation that this 11th Imam lived. And this was because, remember, the Khalafa of Banu Abbas, they are part of Banu Hashim. You know, they are also Banu Hashim. And they knew, like the Ali Ali and Ali Rasul, they knew very clearly the prediction about Imam Mahdi Ajalallahu Ta'ala Faraj Sharif. And they knew, they had the sense that the time has come. Just as Fir'aun and his people knew that the person who is going to destroy his kingdom is going to be born now. This is where he put the Bani Israel under extreme difficulty. Similarly, the Khulafa at that time, during the days of Imam Ali al-Naqi and Imam Hassan Askari alayhi salatu wasalam, basically put the increase the surveillance, because they were, you know, they wanted to make sure if we find out who is going to be the successor of him, we need to eliminate him. And so it was during that time that, you know, yet the Imam, and this is where we see that although the Imamat era was very short, but he was able to communicate with the people and his companions. You know, there are scholars who specialize in biography of the narrators of hadith. You know, they are the ulama of ilm al-rijal, as we call them. And if you look at the number of the companions of the Imam who either have narrated sayings from the 11th Imam or have written, you know, statements from him as a response to their questions, it comes to about 216 companions. These are the names that we know. It must have been much more than that. And looking at the time, you know, that number itself is a pretty good number that, you know, we have the sayings of the Imam, the Ahadith, which has survived till our time in our early books from the companions of Imam Hassan Askari, alayhi salatu wasalam.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen.
Shines above. You're the reason I never give up. You're the one I try for. Live my life for. Give up all I have. You're the melody, you're the key, all the inspiration I need. And when times get tough, I know you'll stand by me. You are the love I need, the one who is God. And you know my destiny, for you are the light, and you are my life. Oh, 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 oh. Oh,
Hello and welcome to a new episode of our program. I am delighted to welcome with us in this episode the representative from the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc, Sheikh Hassan Izzeddin. Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. We mark the first anniversary of the Israeli aggression against Lebanon. This brutal assault began 10 days of darkness. For 10 days, there were devastating strikes against the resistance, from the pagers attack to targeting locations and attacking leaders, including the top-tier leaders. This included an attack on His Eminence Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah. Now, a year after this savage war, what conclusions can we draw? Have there been any results from Hezbollah's internal review regarding the outcomes of this war? What insights have emerged? What allowed the enemy to deliver such significant blows to the resistance in those initial days?
In the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful. There is no doubt that what has happened can be summarized in many ways. I am trying to condense as much as possible what I understand about the situation. Firstly, gaining more knowledge about the enemy reveals that this enemy, whom we thought we knew, has changed and evolved. Whether it's military doctrine, strategy, or tactics, it has transformed and has also surpassed all norms of warfare. When a war arises, it disregards all international laws, and the global community has realized that the essence of this enemy in terms of ideology, faith, and politics is that it places no value on human life or any humanitarian considerations. This is evident from what it has done in the pagers attack. These electronic devices are used by both military forces and civilians. Therefore, even those who carry these pagers are part of the civilian society, living with their families, their fathers, mothers, brothers, and children. Consequently, we did not expect that this enemy would resort to such a devilish and criminal act. This criminal entity doesn't distinguish between the military and the civilian.
If you could turn back time to before October 7th, would you have handled the situation differently and avoided everything that happened, including what was referred to as the collapse of the resistance deterrent capability in the early days of the war?
If the intent of this question is regarding the support war that aided Gaza and defended Lebanon, then we have no regrets and will not regret it. To put it simply, the Palestinian issue is a matter of the entire nation. The sanctities of Palestine are the sanctities of the whole nation as well. Additionally, the injustice that has befallen the Palestinian cause is unimaginable, involving the extermination of a people, the displacement of a people, and the expulsion of a people from their land.
Yes, but if you knew that the cost of this support would be the collapse of Hezbollah's deterrence, the assassination of His Eminence Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, the pagers attack, and the rest.
Because we cannot just sit back and watch the crime, genocide, and devastation on television. This is the first point. The second point is that we were fully aware that if this enemy succeeded in eliminating the resistance factions in Gaza, the next step would be Lebanon. This enemy has two grievances with Lebanon, the liberation in 2000 and the events of 2006. Therefore, we took a preemptive step to protect Lebanon and defend its people. This is also a response to all those who say that the resistance and the weapons are useless.
Regarding the resistance and its weapons being monitored from abroad, particularly some Lebanese factions claim that Hezbollah has been building its strength and power for 40 years. However, the deterrence and balance of power that it accumulated over the years collapsed in just 10 days. What do you have to say about that?
First, when we want to evaluate any topic, we should start from its journey to the moment it reaches. This means that this evaluation inherently responds to all the voices, both internal and external, that discuss the effectiveness of resistance and its weapons. In 1982, the Israeli enemy invaded Lebanon and occupied the second Arab capital. The Islamic resistance was born from the womb of occupation. There was no such thing as a double standard. This Islamic resistance arose as a reaction. The resistance began in 1982 and continued for nearly 18 years, managing to liberate Lebanese land after such a long time, a feat that neither diplomacy, international goodwill, the international community, nor Resolution 425 could achieve. It was the first Arab victory for the resistance against the Zionist enemy, an Arab victory without any privileges, conditions, or restrictions in neither security, political, military, economic, nor anything else. This was the first achievement. The second achievement is that the enemy, along with the Americans, the West, some Arabs, and some Lebanese, engaged in a global and universal war in 2006, yet they managed to endure and remain steadfast, preventing the enemy from achieving its goals. Since 2006 until 2023, we have seen a complete deterrent equation that the enemy could not overcome. So when we discuss this resistance and its weaponry, we must consider it in its entirety, from start to finish, during the period when Lebanon enjoyed prosperity, security, and stability. Ultimately, what happened was that this enemy managed to gain an advantage through technological superiority, artificial intelligence, and human security breaches. I mean, I'm aware of the capabilities I possess, which are capable of creating balance and engaging in a battle where I can achieve victory and inflict defeat on the enemy or prevent the enemy from achieving its goals. But on the other hand, the reality is that this enemy is constantly changing, meaning they are altering their combat doctrine, the methods, tactics, and strategies they employ. So our assessment may involve a certain level of misunderstanding or failure to grasp the true nature of the evaluation that should be made.
Before the incident of the pagers, the Israeli pager attack, which set a record in Zionist crimes and also demonstrated the ability to target a significant number of resistance fighters, Sheikh Naim Qasim stated that there would be an internal investigation into how this occurred. How did the enemy manage to reach every home and every resistance fighter? Have any results emerged from the investigations? What information can you share regarding this matter?
Simply put, let me say that what happened confirms that there is a flaw, which is natural. Based on that, after the events that took place following the war, along with the pagers attack and other matters, and the strike on September 23, where some leaders and personnel were killed, two committees were formed: a technical evaluation committee to assess what occurred and a separate investigation committee. The investigation committee, as you know, will delve into the details and examine where the breaches occurred, where we succeeded, and where we failed. Overall, we can say that there is a breach. First of all, there is a technological gap in it. The other thing is that the enemy has also benefited from the human infiltration. Now, how deep is this infiltration? We are still working on it.
Does this mean we can say that this human infiltration exists within the structure of Hezbollah? Has it reached inside Hezbollah's framework?
Regardless of the internal structure of Hezbollah or its surrounding environment, ultimately there is a human element and a technological superiority that has led to certain outcomes. I believe that after some time, we might see results that are, let's say, if not final, then nearly final.
Will you release the reports?
Certainly, it means that first, on an internal level, we need to address what has happened, because if we don't tackle the mistakes we've made, then who will be responsible for correcting them? In reality, we're all human and everyone makes mistakes. We lose a battle, but we haven't lost the entire war.
I mean, after you reach the confirmations and the investigations prove the betrayers within the body of Hezbollah, those who assisted the enemy and were its agents, will you release this information or will it remain an internal matter?
هاي مرتبطة بطبيعة الخرق وحجم الخرق.
This is related to the nature of the breach, its size, and sometimes the performance of the breach. People can sometimes exaggerate a simple issue, making it seem more significant than it is, and vice versa. This is connected to the security of the resistance in the military resistance apparatus. However, we must point out the areas of error that occurred, whether in assessment, evaluation, performance, tactics, or strategy.
Well, regarding the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, was the breach a technological or a human one?
I believe that regarding this issue, the investigation committees have not yet completed their work.
But some results are starting to appear now.
I mean, no one knows exactly what happened before the investigation committees finished their work.
The enemy claimed a year ago, or during this war lasting 66 days, that they had eliminated 80% of the resistance strength. Yet Netanyahu continues to boast even now that he has significantly diminished or even eradicated Hezbollah. What do you have to say about that?
We faced a strong and harsh blow, particularly at the level of core leadership, especially with the loss of His Eminence Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and Sayyid Hashem Safieddin, along with military leadership and field personnel, among others. However, the resistance remains present, alive and ongoing. This indicates that the blow that did not break our back strengthens us. We faced a blow, yet our structure is healthy, and I believe the path to recovery began the moment we gathered ourselves, so to speak, and managed to restore the positions of those we lost. And also, I can say that even on this first anniversary, our brothers who were injured during the pager attack have also recovered, and in their recovery, the resistance has also healed. Additionally, the restoration of the necessary alternatives is well known to everyone. Thus, we can now say that the resistance has returned to its former strong state, able to perform its tasks, fulfill its duties, and take on its responsibilities.
Well, you agreed to the ceasefire agreement. You stood behind the state and entrusted President Nabi Berri and the Lebanese state to implement this agreement. If you could turn back time to before the ceasefire agreement, which was sponsored by the Americans and lacked any guarantees afterward, and which Israel has exploited to continue its aggressions against Lebanon in all its regions to this day, would you have agreed to this type of ceasefire? What options did you have?
Of course, we need to put things in perspective. I mean, let's take the moment and review the time when the ceasefire was declared and what happened with Hezbollah and how the resistance continued its military and security path until the ceasefire was reached. The enemy was the one who failed to achieve its goals and requested the Americans to intervene for a ceasefire. This indicates that at the moment the resistance agreed to the ceasefire, it had the capability and the resilience to continue. Furthermore, the resistance was indeed in contact with President Nabi Berri, who was also in touch with the party's leadership. Thus, as a result of exchanging points of view and making comments on the draft, this is what happened.
Do you regret agreeing to this type of agreement at the time?
The political, security, and military circumstances that existed during the negotiations, along with the manner in which they were conducted, played a significant role. We must not forget that the balance of power and its disruption influenced this situation. Therefore, the decision made was correct, and anyone in that phase, under the same conditions we faced, would likely have made the same choice. However, the fact of the matter is that the Lebanese state is the one that agreed, and the resistance committed to what it agreed to. Yet the sponsors of this agreement, who were supposed to guarantee it, failed to uphold their end, starting from the Americans to the French and even the Israelis. Consequently, when the opportunity was given to the state to fulfill its responsibilities fully on the basis of...
Do you think the state has fallen short in monitoring this situation and putting pressure on the occupation?
Of course, because from the very start moment, we noticed that the commitment was one-sided without the involvement of the other party.
Now you are being treated in Lebanon and outside Lebanon. Of course, we are talking about the various opposing groups with Hezbollah, I mean America and Israel, as if you have been defeated and therefore you must surrender your weapons. This was the government's decision on the 5th and 7th of August last year. Then there was a meeting in the government on the 5th of September and the army's plan. Today, how do you approach in Hezbollah this path that is working and is determined to disarm the resistance?
Well, there may not be much time to explain the topic of weapons and disarming the resistance exclusively. This term emerged after the Taif Agreement, which was a result of ending a nearly 15-year internal war. It happened because there was confusion regarding the weapons, meaning the disarmament of militias at that time, as the civil war had ended. They aimed to control the weapons that were considered uncontrolled and ensure they were in the hands of the state. This was accomplished, and the weapons of the resistance were also exempted. The proof of this is that in the first government after the Taif Agreement, led by President Harawi and with Prime Minister Salim Al-Hus, the ministerial statement embraced the resistance and its weapons, supporting the resistance to liberate Lebanese land.
The government that supported the resistance and its weapons has changed. Now the government of today claims that Hezbollah is among the militias and we need to disarm it. So what are your thoughts on this? What is your position? How will you realistically deal with this plan?
There's no problem, so we consider the legitimacy of resistance to be valid and present. This is one aspect of the government's decision. If this decision is based on truth and objectivity, I would call it a major sin, because it contradicts the national charter. Therefore, it has exceeded the Constitution, considering that the preamble of the Constitution is part of it, which violates the shared living in rejecting a fundamental component of this issue. Another point is that the legitimacy is supported by statistics or opinion polls, which show that 60% of the Lebanese people refuse to hand over weapons. This weapon, which I would say is legitimate and lawful, taking it away from the resistance does not have the charter or national support either. In reality, when we talk about disarming the resistance, it means stripping Lebanon of its power and ability. This weapon is for the protection of the homeland and its resources. We cannot allow this weapon to be taken away, and we have declared that it cannot be removed under any circumstances or pretext.
The time is up, but I have a question. I would like a brief answer, please. What would you do if you were faced with the army?
We are certainly eager to avoid confrontation with the army. And the army is equally cautious. However, in the end, when faced with the choice, let's say the option to die with honor or to die in surrender, we will never raise a white flag. If it comes to that, we will undoubtedly die the death of the honorable and the free. It is an honor when a person dies for a sacred cause.
Thank you very much, Honorable Deputy Sheikh Hassan Azzeddine, for this opportunity. Dear viewers, this brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you for
watching.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Good afternoon to all our listeners. You are tuned in to Iran Radio. Nice to have you with us. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. Muslim scholar Ibn al-Haytham, known as al-Hazan in Europe, who was born in 965 AD, formulated the scientific method and has been referred to as the world's first true scientist. He is also often regarded as the first theoretical physicist, making a significant contribution to the theory of light and optics. Additionally, he developed what is called celestial mechanics, which led to the eventual work of Europeans such as Copernicus, Galileo, Johannes Kepler, and Isaac Newton. We'll listen to the continuation of Iran Radio. Thank you for joining us. We start off this hour's programs with our news bulletin. That will be followed by Kids Corner. The program is all about children and child's play, a fun program specially made for children. And we round up this hour with our varied radio productions feature.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israeli military continues to pound the Gaza Strip with indiscriminate air and artillery strikes, claiming the lives of more Palestinians in the besieged territory. The activists aboard the Global Samut flotilla say they have entered the high-risk zone where previous flotillas that tried to break the siege of Gaza were attacked by Israel. And also in our headlines, the U.S. government is officially shut down for the first time since 2018 as Republicans and Democrats failed to come to a compromise. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story, the Israeli military continues to pound the Gaza Strip with indiscriminate air and artillery strikes, claiming the lives of more Palestinians in the besieged territory. Over 30 people have been killed in attacks across Gaza since dawn. In Gaza City, two Palestinians were killed in airstrikes targeting residential buildings. Civil defense workers also came under attack as Israeli warplanes struck a school in the Al-Zaytun neighborhood of the same city. In central Gaza, three Palestinians lost their lives after several homes in the Nusayrat and Al-Buraij refugee camps were targeted. The death toll from the U.S. Israeli genocide since October 2023 has climbed to over 66,000, with more than 160,000 others injured. Our correspondent Ghada Ibrahim is joining us now from Deir al-Balah in central Gaza with more. Ghada, please bring us up to speed on all the latest developments from Gaza.
The ground invading continues and the death toll increases really rapidly as a result of the air strikes and as a result of brutal attacks the Israeli occupation army is carrying out against every place in the Gaza Strip from the north to the south. And the most horrific of these massacres was a while ago when the Israeli occupation army or an Israeli airstrike targeted a queue for water in which people were actually queuing, waiting for water. The Israeli occupation army bombed them directly and that resulted in the killing of seven of these people who were waiting for water in order to fill their galloons. The Israeli occupation army again is trying to target all the gatherings of people in all the areas of Gaza City, particularly in the west of Gaza, that is still witnesses a wave of escalated attacks around the hour. The Israeli occupation army keeps bombing the areas that are densely populated and